Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for you people to look at, not look at, to listen to. That's the way it works. And I've had quite a bit good bit of feedback from the last podcast that I did, which was episode number 100, which was my own self-indulgent philosophizing and rambling about stuff. And it seems like quite a few people enjoyed that. A few people seem to be quite confused about it, but it did inspire some people to email for the first time and say how they first found the podcast. Other people have decided to read my own fiction for the first time to check out my own views on it. So I guess it was a successful episode. And I'm really sorry about that. It's been so long to get this one up and running. There's quite a few reasons. The last podcast that I did, I recorded at home. I was at home for just a few hours, about a week ago, whenever it was. And the reason was that is because I had to fly back from Canada, from Newfoundland, back to, and I had to get down to Cape Town for a cruise that I was doing there. And instead of just flying direct there, I actually went home for a few days. But then I had to do my show in German and in English as well, so I had to get prepared for a different kind of show than normal. And I managed to do two overnight flights in 3 days and only get a few hours sleep. So anyway, just one thing after another, a bit stressful, a bit long, lots of stuff going on as well, having to get ready for different shows and doing different traveling stuff. And it all just added up, really. And now it's been, again, quite a long time since I finished this book until I'm doing the review here. In fact, I can't even remember when I finished it, but it was quite a while ago. But I do remember a lot of it, and hopefully this review is going to go okay. The reason why I'm doing this review of Lucifer's Hammer by Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle is because it's been quite a while since I've read one of these books, these classic books. You've got like The Mote in the God's Eye and Footfall and Lucifer's Hammer, all written by the same two authors, sort of generally considered to be modern classics. I last read this book probably, 10 or 12 years ago, and I just wanted to see how it stands up. And of course, this book was written back in the 1970s, 1977, and again, I just wanted to see how well it stands up as good science fiction or just as good fiction, and we'll see how it goes. Maybe I'll read some of the other books or listen to some of the other books, because I listened to this one as an audiobook. So let's get straight into it then. The world of this book is pretty much 1970s Los Angeles and surrounding areas, sort of Southern California kind of area as well. Some things happen elsewhere, but mainly in California, to the point where that, it's, I'm talking just California, like they mention like streets, so they went down this street and then this road and went to this town and stuff like that, and nowhere else is mentioned except to say that, hey, it's gone under a wave, like all of Europe, that's wiped out. And we get maybe like a page talking about the destruction of the rest of the world, maybe another page talking about the destruction of the rest of America. But really, it concentrates so much on LA. And like I said, it follows the roads and all this different stuff. So I was thinking, if I had a map, I'd probably be able to follow the paths of the characters from one town to the next, from one hill to the next, from one valley to the next, from one street to the next. Thing is, I was listening to it as not on an audiobook. And maybe there's a map in the book itself, but I didn't have it. And I don't live in Los Angeles. And I don't sort of know the area, even, I've never visited there, don't live there, so I was a little bit confused in some points. But this could be classed as like an end of the world book, but really isn't an end of the world book. It really is like the end of civilization in California kind of book, because even in other parts of the United States, there's other stuff going on, and they say lots of Africa survived unscathed, a lot of Australia survives and stuff like that, and so does South America. But really, the story that they're wanting to concentrate on is just in Los Angeles. I say it's the end of the world now, but because the plot is about a comet hitting Earth, or breaking into pieces, hitting Earth. The way that it works is this: the first third of the novel is all the setup. So we meet lots of different characters, but a lot of it is spent with the guy who discovers the comet, and the scientists, and they're describing it, and also there's a mission which is sent up into space too with these astronauts, and their plan isn't to deflect this comet that they see coming that might hit the Earth. It's just to observe it as it goes past. Oh, that's the idea. And the thing is, it breaks into pieces and then hits the Earth all the way across, all the way around the northern hemisphere. Meanwhile, of course, just before that happens, of course, people are getting ready for it to hit, and some people don't get ready for it to hit, you know, and there's these, lots of people stock up on food and guns, and other people head to the hills, and others sort of work out what they're going to do here, and if they can get away with stuff now, you know, because they think, well, when the comet hits, all the bad stuff that I've done is going to be wiped clean, and other people, you know, working out the same thing, all these criminals are thinking out, well, even if the comet doesn't hit, all of these people are going to be away from their, you know, Hollywood Hills homes, and we can, you know, rob them and do all that kind of stuff, and then head out and do different things, you know, like that, and we can take all the televisions and all that kind of stuff. So that's the first third of the book. The second third of the book, which is actually a slightly smaller third, is when the comet hits and we experience the comet hitting in lots of different ways. I mentioned there's lots of different characters that we get introduced in the first third of the book. Because there's so many different characters, they all have a chance of describing how the comet hits, except you don't see it actually from their point of view. And this is a little bit of a complaint that I have. If you're going to talk about, like, if you're going to have all these different characters live through the same event and sort of, you know, describe what they go through, I'd really much prefer the book to have actually gone a little bit more into detail about, you know, from their point of view, what they think is happening, what, you know, they're perceiving. But we're really told that, oh, there's an earthquake, and then this person did this, and then this happened, and then that person did this. And over here, there was an earthquake and a wave, and that person did this. And over here, there was an earthquake and a wave and a thunderstorm and this, and then that person did that. Whereas really, I'd have liked to have been a little bit more sort of inside the heads of some of these characters, and, you know, in that way. But anyway, but it is a good way to get a broad overview of what happens when the comet hits the Earth, or off the coast of California, or inland from California as well. And then, of course, this third of the book continues with lots of different characters making their way to safety, and all of them are heading to the hills and things like that. This part of the book sort of mushes together. You know, I enjoyed it quite a lot when I was listening to it, but now I can't actually remember who was driving what, because a lot of it, I'm not just kidding, there's a lot of people finding vehicles and driving down narrow dirt roads into the hills, and then somebody else will also have a big vehicle and drive, and then someone else will have like a smaller, also a four-wheel drive, and they'll drive this way, and somebody else will be on a horse and they're going down a road, and some people will be on a motorbike and they're going down the road, and it just seems a little bit samey, with the same event being told, you know, the same comet strike being told over and over again, and then lots of trucks driving down narrow roads. However, like I say, at the time when I was reading it, it was quite interesting, because I was wondering, okay, this person did this, and this person was doing this, this person was doing it. So there's lots of stuff going on. Then the third third of the book is the people that we have been following for the first two thirds, trying to set up a new life after the comet has hit. And most of them head or end up in this secluded valley in the hills, the Californian hills, and they're fighting against lots of different things. First of all, you know, against starvation, and then sort of generally society falling apart. And then there's, towards the end of it, there's sort of like the big forces of evil come rolling in, and the evil black people and religious people and environmentalists. It was pretty much the way it goes. So the problem that I had a little bit with the plot is that it really needs more focus, because if it's a story about life after the comet, the comet should really strike sooner, and we should really go for, like, what happens afterwards. So it's like a real post-apocalyptic thing. So the apocalypse happens, and then what happens afterwards. But it isn't really that, because there's a lot of non-apocalypse before we actually get to the apocalypse. So if it's a story about the lead-up to the comet striking and what people are going to do about it, that should have, you know, been the majority of the book, and then it should have ended more where the comet struck. But like I say, there's these three distinct parts, and then the plot sort of doesn't so much switch from one to the other. It sort of lurches from one mode to the next. It goes, build it, right, now, okay, now we're going to do comet striking, and then it goes, right, okay, now we've sorted out where everyone is, now we're just going to have a break for a week or two, and now we're going to go post-apocalyptic, and then it's post-apocalyptic. Can't say that three times over quickly. So that's the way it goes. And like I say, I'd prefer it. Actually, just take you back. I was mentioning this beforehand in my previous episode that I recorded about me, you know, what I was thinking when I first started up this podcast. One of the test reviews that I did, I actually managed to do sort of like a 7-minute book review of a book called Nemesis. And I can't actually remember who the writer was of Nemesis, but it was about a comet coming to hit the Earth. And it was a bit sort of like, it was saying like, oh, okay, it's something to do, you know, it's a bit like the Da Vinci Code, because it's, you know, someone had mentioned this comet, you know, some astronomer back in, you know, 500 years ago had mentioned this comet was passing by, and they realized that the way to work out what this comet was and what it was coming through. And then the big twist at the end of this, not at the end of this sort of science fiction-y thriller kind of comet hitting the Earth book is that there is no comet. It was all a big conspiracy theory, and nothing actually happened. And the comet, which was meant to be coming out of the sun, it was all just a big setup. I can't remember all the details, but it was quite interesting that there was this whole big setup where the whole world was getting ready for a comet coming in, and it was just a conspiracy. It never actually happened. The people who said it was coming, it wasn't happening, and it was all for some, I know, some kind of weapons testing kind of thing. I can't even remember what it was now. But it was an interesting story, nevertheless, and it had a focus that he knew, the writer knew what he was wanting to do, and then he did it, and then at the end, it ended, and that was it. Whereas this seems to be a little bit sort of like, okay, what's the focus? Not really sure. However, like I said, as I was listening, I was with it probably around about 85, 90% of the time. I wanted to know who would make it and who wouldn't. Even though I've actually read the book before, I couldn't remember, because there's so many characters, I couldn't remember who does what or what people did what. And I'm not just wanting to know what happens next in a sort of like, what happens next. I've mentioned that in previous reviews as well. There has to be something a little bit more to it than I wonder what is happening next. Even just a sort of with a straight sort of adventure story, which this sort of seems to be, you need to have some questions that are, you know, are left unanswered and that get answered by the end of the novel. And it seems to happen here as well. So moving on to a bit towards the, what's next up in my notes, the characters. Oh yeah. Lots of characters, all doing lots of interesting things. Actually, sometimes not doing interesting things, but there's enough interesting stuff going on, with these characters to sort of that, you know, they're all, I don't think all of them needed to be in the book, but most of them were doing interesting stuff, because there is, like I say, a big, big cast, and you don't know who's going to make it to the end. Some people die that you like, and they die on the page, and other people sort of die elsewhere, and then their deaths are reported, and other people go, oh, can't believe it, that person died, and stuff like that. But there's lots of, I'm not even going to reel off, because there's so many different characters. I guess the main two characters, there's this astronomer, who's not really an astronomer, he's just he's like a playboy sort of guy, and he's inherited a lot of money, and he spent it on a telescope, and he scans the skies, and he's the one who discovers the comet at the beginning. But then after that, he doesn't really have much to do, so he's just, you know, helping make these, you know, these documentaries with this other guy. I guess that's the other main character as well, or the character that we spend a lot of time with, is this documentary maker. And these two guys, you're always expecting them to be the heroes, and sort of they are heroes at some point, and sometimes not. But, you know, they're all, like I say, they're all trying to get to this one place, they're all trying to survive in this world, they're all trying to get to safety. Another thing that I like about this whole big cast of characters is that not many of them are very clever. There are sort of a few people who are quite clever in some ways, but then not in others. And other people are clever in some ways, and then not in others. And they sort of scrape by, and it's only when they all get to, you know, they all get together. Even the most prepared characters are sort of caught out in some way, and it's only when they have people who have complementary skills and things that they can actually band together and work their way through this disaster that's unfolding. And that's actually a really interesting part of it. It's sort of like it doesn't help enough just to be good with a gun. You've got to be this and this and this, and it doesn't help if you're going to do this if you don't agree with that. And yeah, it's just sort of like the way that these different you know, these different skills and these different mindsets and these different outlooks and skill sets and things, how they all fit together, I thought was quite interesting. And that's the way that I like these casts being played out. The bad about a big cast is that it's really too big. It takes too long to introduce everyone at the beginning. The start of the book sort of really drags along a bit, because you're going, okay, and there's this character, and you're like, okay, was that the same character as before? Something like this, because some of them, you know, there's one character called Harry, and there's another character called Harvey, and there's another character called Hardy, and there's another character called Hindi. No, I'm just joking. I think there's at least a Harry, a Harvey, and a Hardy, and sometimes they're in the same room with each other, and Hardy and Harvey are having a conversation. I was just like, wait, was that Hardy who just said that, or was it Hardy who just said that, or was it Hardy, or which one did I mention before? So too many characters, and there's just, yeah, like lots of names to keep track of. And I guess if I was reading it like in a paper book, I could keep track a little bit easier, but because it's an audio book, it was a bit too much to get through. Another thing that seems to be a bit strange about this big cast of characters is how they all seem to arrive at generally the kind of same place by the end of the book. It felt a bit forced, and yet unbelievable and yet predictable all at the same time, which is a bit of a strange thing to have, to feel, have it feeling forced and unbelievable and predictable. If the beginning of the book would, was sort of like saying, hey, this is the story, or maybe sort of like a fictional author in as like part of the book, sort of like as a little bit of a frame story or as a little bit of an introduction saying, hey, here's a story of how we all managed to get together and be in the same place after the hammer fell. And then you'd only need that line or something, and then you'd realise that actually all of the characters in the book are going to end up in the same area. But it seems a bit strange that, you know, they're all set off and they all got these different plans, and yet somehow, you know, they all get together in the same place, and it just seems a little bit forced. It's like, well, of course there's lots of other people who don't make it there, and also lots of other people who don't survive, and this is the story of the people who do survive and who do have something in common and who do manage to get to the same place. But yet it's like, it just felt a little bit clunky in that way. Another weird thing is that the sex seems to be a massive driving motivation in too many people's lives, both before the hammer fell and after the hammer fell, the comet hit, and after the comet hit. Maybe this is a good thing because it shows that people's, you know, just because there's a massive disaster, maybe they don't change, like their entire lives don't change, everything doesn't change about them, they've still got the same hang-ups, they've still got, you know, they're still thinking about sex all the time. But it just seemed to be a bit strange considering, like, billions and billions and billions of people have just died, and yet the main thought on some of these character minds is still like if they're gonna have sex with this one person or not, or if they're gonna cheat on their wife or not, or if they're going to do this or not, or if they're gonna have sex with someone who's underage or not, or if they're gonna rape someone or not. You know, it's just this weird thing that the whole sex drive thing seemed to be a little bit too strong after the comet hit. I thought there was so much sex at the beginning of the novel because then once the hammer hit, everyone had realized that actually they didn't want to just sleep around and the best thing to do is to stick with the people that they loved and do all that. But no, it didn't seem to be that. It was still lots of sex afterwards. Again, I don't mind sex, but, you know, it just seemed a little bit strange that was happening. The last bad point about the characters, it's not so much a character thing, it's more of a plot thing. Like, I guess I have it here in the notes, in my notes here, is that the government seemed to fall a little bit too easily after the comet fell. They seemed a little bit too unprepared. And I know that the authors wanted this to be an apocalyptic book, that they wanted to tell the story post-apocalypse. However, it isn't just a book about post-apocalypse, because it's also a book about pre-apocalypse, pre-comet strike. It seems a bit like... It seems a bit convenient that lots of people were preparing for the comet to strike, except the people who really needed to, like the military and, you know, the government. There seemed to be like one like throwaway line or one throwaway half chapter with this one guy going up in the sort of, what is it, the military command bird, the one, you know, the eyes in the sky, not the eyes in the sky, what am I trying to say, the plane that goes up and they have the red telephone in it, and that they can control all of the forces of the United States from a single plane, so they're safe even after the nuclear strike. That plane as well, that's mentioned once in one chapter, and then it seems to just be forgotten again by the end of it. And then after the comet strikes, like, all of the military are just taken out of the equation, all of the government seems to be taken out of the equation. Like I say, just seemed a little bit too convenient anyway. However, there's some bad parts about the story and the characters and stuff, but there are lots and lots and lots of memorable moments. Unfortunately, most of the memorable moments don't have to do with the main characters, which is a bit strange. For example, at the beginning of the book, in the first part of the book, there's this character who falls in love with someone, but he's actually this weird stalker kind of rapist kind of guy. And he's someone who goes, ah, well, when the comet falls, when I manage to rape this woman, I'm taken into jail, it won't matter anymore because, it's because the comet's fall, and then all slates will be wiped clean and I'm going to be killed by the comet anyway, so it doesn't matter what I do beforehand. And I thought actually that was quite an interesting thing to set up at the beginning of the book and you know, what you can do that way. And there's another character as well who's this banker, and again it came as quite a surprise what his plan was at the beginning of the book, because it's a bit strange that he was wanting to kill himself, and then he's like, oh, and now the comet's going to fall, and it's like, well, what's going to happen then? And his story takes, I think, quite an interesting turn. And there's another character who's a policeman who, as soon as the comet strikes, he realizes immediately that everything is going to go to hell. And he goes into a prison, and he's like, okay, do I release these prisoners, or do I keep them locked up, or what do I do with them? And it's really interesting as he goes down into these prison cells and decides who he's going to release and who he's just going to kill straight away. He's taking justice into his own hands, life and death into his own hands as he does it as well. What else is there? Yeah, there's the bit where the surfer rides the tsunami into the in across the landscape of Los Angeles, and that's really cool. And there's a bit with the postman, and if you've read The Postman by David Brin, it's pretty much like a miniature version of that. He, you know, the letters must get through, and he doesn't realize that the world has come to the end. He just thinks his car's broken down and the weather's pretty bad. He does have some impact on the main plot, but not a huge amount. And there's the lone scientist who tries to preserve his library against everything, and he has the one book called How Things Work, and he's like, this is the book that's going to be the most important book after the apocalypse, and he saves it and he goes away. You know, it's a little bit sort of like a canticle for Leibowitz kind of thing going on there as well. And there's lots of other nice moments as well. I really like the driving along the railway tracks as well, and also the diving, deep sea diving into a new lake, a new sea that's been flooded, to get sort of supplies from the shops. Like I said, there's lots and lots of really great touches before and during and after the comet hits. It, like I say, that's what you want from a really good adventure book. And it is a pretty good adventure book. Lots of stuff going on, lots of gunfights, lots of violence. Yeah, I might as well get into some about talk about the writing style. There is lots of violence. There's lots of sex, not graphic sex, but quite a lot of it. Sometimes there's sex and violence at the same time. It's not really kind of high literature. Lots of the dialogue is passable, bit folksy, you know, the kind of way that you say folksy. It's sort of like, hey, how are you doing? What's going on here? I don't even really know how to explain the sort of dialogue. It's not very realistic. It's more sort of, it reminds me of sort of like, you know, like the 1950s, 1960s Heinlein dialogue, where it's all like, hey, gee, what about this? But and not really strange. The main problem with the writing that I had, though, is pretty much the pacing, as I was saying before. It could have just been tightened up with less characters, and it meant that the whole book felt a little bit, not top-heavy, but a bit lumpy as you go through. It's like this, and then 2 weeks later, it's this, and I was like, wait, back away a bit. I want to know what happens there and stuff. So that's a bit strange. Oh, the science, that's it. Science and technology. Most of the science, the good science in this book, is really in the sort of run-up to the comet strike. Because it's very clearly defined and very clearly explained, and it's, you know, they actually talk, because there's a guy making a documentary about it, you see, and he goes and interviews these scientists, and they're like, this will happen, and then this will happen, and if the comet is this big, this will happen, and if the comet breaks up into pieces, this will happen, and then what if this happens, and this will happen, and it's all explained quite in quite a lot of technical detail, and I actually really quite enjoyed all of that. I mean, it's not something that I don't know already, because all science fiction fans know what tsunamis are going to be, and know how much energy is in a falling piece of rock, and know how fast stuff moves in space and stuff, so it's not actually anything new, but because all of the science seems to end, or all of the hard science seems to end at the comet strike, it really, that's when you really understand that this really isn't science fiction. It really is like some kind of, you know, thriller, like adventure thriller kind of stuff, because everything after that is purely about people surviving. And I think I mentioned this before in my podcast about how Michael Crichton doesn't really write science fiction. He writes thrillers, but it's like that, you know, how the first half of it, the science sets up a big problem, and then people survive generally by their own sort of, like, there's not a scientific or a technological way out of the problem. It's more sort of to do with running and jumping and shooting and climbing ladders and things like that. And that's what this book really is. At the end of it as well, there's a bit about, oh, yes, we've got to do this, and we've got to stand up for science, and we've got to do this, and it's all about rationality, and we've got to, you know, we've got to get through, and we've got to create a good society. But it does then, I wouldn't say devolve into sort of social science fiction, but it turns into that kind of like the creation of a dystopia kind of novel, which is done so many times in science fiction. And I actually enjoy it when it's done well, and you know, the sort of when you get together some people and, you know, get together a big group of people and say, and run with it, and you get this big group of people and they're like, oh, okay, right, we've got to set up a government, and we've got to set up an army, and we've got to set up a committee, and we've got to set up a science, and we've got to set up schools, and we've got to set up this and set up that, and the intentions are really good, but then of course the black people turn up and everything goes bad. And I'm not just saying that about this book, but it seems to happen over and over in quite a lot of these sort of like new society, or society after apocalypse, or society starting up anew on a spaceship in outer space, and all these different kind of stuff. It happens time and time again. And that brings me to the themes of the book, which is strangely enough, the main thing that I got out of this book is that really the meek shall not inherit the earth, and the blacks will not inherit the earth, and the religious people will not inherit the earth, and the poor will not inherit the earth. The people who are going to inherit the earth, or at least Southern California after the comic strikes, is pretty much the white, middle class, male men, stereotypical white male middle class stuff, because anyone who isn't middle class white male is portrayed in a very kind of, well, of course, if they're not that, they seem to be portrayed sexist or racist, and the word, which I can't remember, which I guess is classist as well, where you sort of sneer at the country folk and stuff like that. To begin with, I first thought the racism was the most blatant, because it's like unending and unavoidable. As soon as there's a black character, it's like, okay, well, you know, there's this person, this black character's black, and this black character, he's black, and he's going to do some bad stuff because he's black. Or not because he's black, but there isn't going to be any non-black characters, you know, who do bad stuff. I mean, there are, but it just seems a bit strange that right at the beginning there it is. And then through to the end of the book, it really is rationality on one side and insanity on the other, and peace on one side and war on the other side, and science on one side and Ludditism on the other side. And on one side, it's always being represented by, you know, middle class white men. And on the other side, it's being represented by poor black men leading faceless hordes against them. And I'm saying, just a little bit strange, you know. At first, I thought that, wait a second, you know, it could be the intention of the book is to show that when everything falls apart, we're going to fall into our, like, racial groups and societal groups and class groups, and then we all fight out among ourselves. And I think, well, that'd be fine. But in that case, it would be nice if we actually saw the rationale, like the rational rationale behind both sides. For example, the white people have great motivations and noble motivations, and it's all about, yes, we've got to get science, and it's going to be good, and we're going to keep together, and we're going to band together, and it's going to be great. Oh, and it's a pity that all these poor people out there who can't look after themselves, we can't look after them, so we're going to have to exclude them from our stronghold into the end. And you think, oh, okay, that's great. But then on the side outside, I thought, okay, so on the black side, you know, because they get this band of criminals who, first of all, they're wanting to steal televisions, and then they realize, actually, no, the shit is going down here. So what we got to do is we got to get out of town. And I thought it'd been really great if they could set up a rival, but equally good or equally interesting or equally reputable or equally admirable society, which just happens to be all black, but yet in the same, you know, in a sort of on a level playing field there with the white middle class people. But it doesn't happen that way. It, you know, they just turn into, you know, this band, or they join up with this band of religious fundamentalist whack jobs as well, and environmentalists and things, which I'll get into in a second. But then it can't only, like I say, it's a bit strange that you'd think, okay, so that doesn't happen, but okay, maybe the other groups of people, when they get together and you get the young kids getting together and stuff, but no, they're really actually only just interested in sex at the end, and the only reason why the young people want to stay away from the adults is because they'd stop them having sex anymore, because they're having underage sex, which is a bit weird. And then you get the women as well, and you're like, oh, okay, the women will be fine afterwards as well. But then you realize, actually, no, the women were being like, really, it was like the book was actually quite sexist before the hammer fall and afterwards. And, you know, the women are sort of like just being used as breeding stock and as pawns and as things to make love to, and it's that felt a bit weird as well, both before and after the hammer fall. And so, yeah, it's just a bit strange, really, that you think, well, oh, yeah, and the poor people as well. You think, well, the poor people beforehand are sort of downtrodden. They're not even mentioned because, you know, the characters aren't really at that level. The only poor people who are mentioned are the black criminals. And then afterwards, there are some poor people mentioned, but they're sort of allowed to be poor. They're okay because they know how to use guns, and they can be the heavies. They can be the guys who protect the rich white people. While the rich white people get on and save the earth and save civilization, the poor people, they'll be good to, you know, shoot the black people. So that's it. We'll send the poor people against the black people and the religious fundamentalists, and we'll get the white people and the you know, the white middle class people to stay behind and save the world. Yeah, maybe I read a bit too much into it, but it was really, it's just, you know, again, I actually enjoyed the whole adventure part of it, and I enjoyed the thriller part of it, and I enjoyed the science part of it, and I enjoyed the, you know, the driving and the fights and all this kind of stuff. But it just seemed a little bit weird with all the sexism and racism and classism that was going on too. Not very well balanced. Next thing, just a final little note that I have here, not that long a review it seems this time out, is The Environmentalist. It seemed to be quite a little cheap shot by Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle against the sort of like environmentalists. It's like, oh yeah, you know, well, they're stupid, really. They should just pollute, and they should, because it doesn't matter, because, you know, after the comet is struck, it doesn't matter how much we pollute or how much nuclear power we waste or how much, you know, not nuclear power, how many nuclear weapons rain down, because it doesn't really matter, because, you know, the earth is fucked anyway, so it doesn't matter. So let's just get on with it. And those environmentalists, well, they're as bad as, you know, the raving lunatic black, you know, hordes that are coming in anyway. They, of course, they'd join up over there. And so, but it seems to be a bit of a cheap shot, because like the position of the environmentalist seems to be a little bit disingenuous here. And also, it's a bit handy that the disaster that strikes isn't something which mankind has any say in. It's like, okay, disasters which can destroy the world or bring the end to the earth, which could be, you know, which aren't caused by man. Okay, you get like comets striking, earthquakes are localized, so that's not like an end of the world kind of thing. Volcanoes also localized. I guess maybe some kind of cosmic ray surge or the sun spitting out lots of radiation. That could wipe out a lot of life on Earth, and that could be an end of the Earth thing. But it's pretty much comets and cosmic rays or radiation from space to wipe out the Earth. But then I'm thinking, well, what about all the things that man can do which can also cause a doomsday scenario? You know, like, oh, nuclear war, which is the easiest, like, doomsday kind of thing. And then you get, like, you know, like lots of pollution and some other big, you know, science thing going wrong and all these different things going wrong, like lots of, you know, the ice caps melting and the seas rising, all of that kind of stuff. Now, I'm not saying that we should all live in communes, but sometimes the environmentalists have a point, you know, when it comes to saving the world. Actually, maybe the way to save the world isn't to wait until a comet to strike and then set up a new shining white middle-class white person's utopia in Southern California and kill off all the black people. Maybe that's not the way to go. Maybe it's actually to sort of listen to the environmentalists while they're talking now, so then later we don't have to kill all of the black people, all us middle-class white people don't have to kill all the black people and things like that. Again, maybe I'm being a little bit facetious, maybe I'm misrepresenting the book in another way, but it seems to be like a little bit of a cheap shot just to mix in the environmentalists with you know, the people talking, like saying, hey, let's not have nuclear power. And it's like, well, okay, nuclear power is not all that bad, but it seems a bit strange that at the end of the book, I'm going to have a little minor spoiler here, which I think I've not really spoiled the book, because you know what the book is about anyway, really. But at the end of the book, there's this whole thing about saving a nuclear power station. And I'm like, oh, that's great. They have a nuclear power station, which they can, you know, turn on and have power again. It's sort of set up quite obviously at the beginning of the book that this is going to be a big part of the end of the book. But it seemed a bit strange that maybe, I'm just putting it out there, maybe the power that, like, the power production that survives a massive comet strike isn't going to be the one brand new nuclear power station. It's probably going to be like they mentioned dams and things like that with the power plants in the dams, the hydroelectric. But wouldn't the thing that most people will be able to make electricity out of, wouldn't it just be burning stuff, like burning coal and burning wood? You know, that would be the easiest way, like steam power and you know, run generators off burning stuff, which again isn't a good way to save the earth now, just by, you know, more and more coal burning power stations. Anyway, just a little thing that occurred to me you know, after I'd finished the book. Finally, in terms of themes, cannibalism, really not all that bad, guys. You know, if you need to eat someone to get by, eat someone to get by. It's not a big deal, seriously. Anyway, that brings the end to my review here. Not a long review, but again, it's a bit strange when it's sort of like a popcorn movie adventure book like this. There's not a lot of depth to get into. I mean, I could talk more about the different characters and stuff, but there's so many of them that if I was to really get into depth about all of it, it would take me like 4 hours to go through all the different characters and all the different storylines in this book. So I thought just a more of a general overview of this book. I'm going to give it 3.5 stars because it is this fun adventure. I'd really like to see it actually rewritten. It would be great if Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle could get together and do like a non-racist edit of this book, or sort of a bit more up to date, because the 1970s Californian setting is like really, that's quite dated as well. I don't think I mentioned that at the beginning, but it does feel a bit strange. Still set it in the 1970s, but sort of update the attitudes and update the ideas a bit to sort of fit in with the modern world could be a nice project. Maybe someone gets it in a Word document or something like that. Someone else could edit it together. I think more people should edit old books like this and to sort of do their own remix versions of it. I think that would be a fun project for someone who wants to do that. I mean, it's a lot of work, of course, but it would be interesting. You know, it's like how was it Thomas Jefferson who rewrote or who wrote his own or translated his own version of the New Testament and took out all the miracles of Jesus, that kind of thing. It would be great to see sort of like a Lucifer's Hammer non-racist version. You know, I mean, I think it would be quite easy to do, or maybe a non-sexist version. So instead of having every single person who does anything of note to be male, actually maybe have, hey, check it out, maybe the most important woman character isn't just going to be the trophy wife, or maybe the most important and most useful woman character isn't going to be the secretary. Maybe, just come to think of it, maybe one of the scientists could be a woman, or maybe one of the politicians could be a woman, or maybe one of the, you know, one of the people who are good with a gun could be a woman. Actually, no, come to think of that, there is one character who has quite a surprising transformation, or quite a surprising journey, and she is a female, and she actually does become a bit of a hero figure by the end of the book. A bit of a strange hero figure, a bit of a slut of a hero figure, but it is quite interesting the way her character turns. So actually, maybe there's a glimpse of non-sexism in this book, which I'd forgotten about, or is sort of buried under all the other sexism, racism, and classism in this book. But again, I don't want to put too much emphasis on the sexism, racism, classism, because there is actually a good book underneath all of that, which I actually quite enjoy. So that'll do for me and for this review. Thanks a lot for listening. Oh, next book. It's The Lies of Locke Lamora. And I have it here. Let me pick it up. By Scott Lynch. And I'm on page, let me check it out, I'm on page 546 of like 600 or something like that. So I've only got, well, I've probably got about 100 pages to go, actually, of this book. Really enjoying it. It's a fantasy novel, and that's it. Otherwise, on my iPod, as on audiobook, coming up next, I guess, let me just quickly look here. I have House of Sons by Alistair Reynolds there, and also I've got this new thing, came through from Audible, and it said, hey, check it out, you might want to spend a credit on this. The Alchemist and the Executionist by Pablo Bacigalupi and Tobias S. Buckell, two authors who I'm interested in, one whose book I read and really enjoyed, and another whose book I read and sort of enjoyed a lot of the ideas in it, but was let down by the writing. Anyway, this is two novellas, so I thought I'd just do a little download that, because it seems quite interesting, and it's not a book, it's audio only, and I guess I'll get to that next, or in a few reviews time, and say more about that, see if it's worth spending your Audible credit on if you want to do that. Otherwise, that's it. Thanks a lot for listening. You can contact me, luke@juggler.net is the best way to get in contact. Just email me. I do reply to every single email that is sent to me. It might take me a few days, it might take me a week or so, but I do get back to everyone as well. If you just want to follow what I'm doing, two ways to do that is go to my blog, which is lukeburge.com/blog, and everything that I do which is not SFBRP related goes on there, all my photography and videos and juggling. And if you want to keep up with my travels as well, I've just been to Cape Town, South Africa for the first time, and Namibia for the first time. So if you want to see some photos and some videos from those places, check that out. Otherwise, you can follow me on Twitter, which most things I do get mentioned on Twitter as well. That's @LukeBurge on Twitter. Finally, if you want to see what I'm reading or where I'm up to in the books that I'm doing, and also if you want me to be able to see what you're reading very easily, go to goodreads.com/LukeBurge, follow my reviews, become my friend, whatever you want to do there. That's the good thing, because I do enjoy seeing, like, because now I had this page open before. Let me go to the goodreads.com page on Lucifer's Hammer, it says you rated it 4 stars. I actually rated it 3.5 stars, but 4 stars was the easiest way to go because it's a good 3.5 stars. And then it goes friends reviews. Dan rated it 4 stars. Zivian rated it 4 stars. Ryan rated it 4 stars. Julie D rated it 5 stars. Chris rated it 4 stars. So I can actually see sort of like the overview. Simon Hedge rated it 2 stars. He didn't like it. Patrick rated it 4 stars. David Monroe rated it 4 stars. So you can actually see that you can see what it goes. As I go through, I can see what you're thinking of the books that I'm reading, and your comments go directly onto my review here as well. So that's the best way to do it. Otherwise, thanks for listening. I think I said that 3 times now. Anyway, I'll catch you next time.